Over the last few decades, left-wing activists and academics have by and large rejected Marxism and its emphasis on class and class struggle. In particular, Marxism has been attacked for ignoring or downplaying questions of oppression. The idea that society consists of a series of separate but overlapping identities based on things such as gender, race, class, sexual orientation, national identity, and cultural practices is now widespread. Society, so the argument goes, consists of different, sometimes competing interest groups. No overarching analysis of society can take all of these differences into account and unite them into a coherent framework. That is the essence of what a lot of those sort of postmodern theorists would contend. Marxism is viewed as unable to deal with oppression because it's concerned only with class exploitation. The views of one feminist author writing in 1979 are still fairly widespread, at least in the United States. Marx never questioned the hierarchical sexual ordering of society, she argued. Marx is similarly attacked for his supposed lack of attention to racism. To quote one academic, ethnic and racial conflicts were not subjects to which Marx gave much close attention. Although Marx acknowledged these types of divisions in society, he does not appear to have been much interested in explaining their dynamics, we're told. Obsessed with the supposedly more fundamental category of socioeconomic identity, namely class, Marx slighted race and sex and did not grant them a place of their own in his historical work, is argued. And these ideas about Marxism didn't pop out of nowhere. Like many crappy ideas, they came out of the academy. They were developed by mostly middle-class intellectuals who came to consciously distance themselves from a class analysis of society. Many of them had, in fact, participated in the mass social upheavals of the 1960s and 70s. Others read about those struggles, but then watched in confusion as they declined or disappeared. In addition, some looked at the contemporary societies that used the rhetoric of socialism to justify inequality in the former Soviet bloc or in Cuba, and concluded that socialism was a failed strategy or goal and launched a project to discredit and rethink Marxism. In fact, there's a sort of whole rethinking Marxism industry in the English language. I found there's entire sections of especially progressive bookstores, I noticed, that are devoted to this topic. The notion that Marxism is somehow indifferent to women's oppression is an entirely modern phenomenon. This would have been unheard of or unthought of prior to the 1960s. People might have rejected the idea of women's liberation, but not the idea that Marxism and women's liberation were somehow in opposition to each other. The idea that Marx and Engels ignored or downplayed oppression because they privileged class is simply absurd. What they and Marx has since have argued is that, number one, various oppressions cannot be understood separately from capitalism because capitalism shapes and depends upon oppression for its survival. And number two, the most thoroughgoing struggle against oppression cannot be carried out on the basis of separate struggles of the oppressed, each united across class lines. Such a struggle will always be limited by the narrow interests of bourgeois and middle-class elements within the oppressed group who will seek to limit the scope of the struggle within the confines of capitalism. Only the working class, that is to say, black, white, Latino, gay, straight, women, men, who make up the working class, has both the collective power and the common interest to fight for complete liberation. Now, the Marxist tradition essentially goes something like this, in a nutshell. Here's a potted history. Capitalism is a society based on the exploitation of the many by the few. Got it. Because it is founded on massive inequality, it requires various means to oppress and keep down the working class and the poor. The ruling classes of the world know the value of divide and rule, both as a means to weaken any opposition against them and as a means to squeeze more profit from the working class. The working class is not only an exploited class, it is also an oppressed class. In other words, to Marxists, even white, straight men, male workers, are oppressed. Workers receive worse education, worse housing, and worse job opportunities than the sons and daughters of the middle class and of the rich. Workers are constantly reminded that they do not possess the intelligence or the capabilities of those above them on the social ladder. Workers are disadvantaged at every step, stressed under financial and family constraints, forced to work in dangerous jobs and therefore more likely to suffer from various physical and mental ailments. In turn, they are then forced to accept the poorest quality health care if they get any at all. Racial, sexual, national, linguistic, and other oppressions interact with the basic class oppression to produce sections within the working class who are doubly or specially oppressed. Marx and Engels were clear that capitalism, a system based on the exploitation of wage labor for profit, was founded on enslavement and oppression from its beginnings. As Marx put it himself, the fellow who supposedly ignored racial oppression, the discovery of gold and silver in America, the extirpation, enslavement, and entombment of mines of the indigenous population of that continent, the beginnings of the conquest and plunder of India, and the conversion of Africa into a preserve for the commercial hunting of black skins are all things that characterize the dawn of the era of capitalist production. These idyllic proceedings are the chief moments of primitive accumulation. So what do they have to say, Marx and Engels, on women's oppression in particular? Marx and Engels rejected outright the idea upheld by conservatives, but also by many people who consider themselves feminists, that the low status of women was an unchanging feature of human existence, fixed for all time by human biology or by the ideas in people's heads. Women's position in society has been conditioned by the particular stage of development of the productive forces of society, and corresponding to that, the given social relations of a particular society. Women's status in society has always been related to the role that they have played in and the different forms taken by the family in history. Women's status, for example, was very different in pre-class societies. Engels describes how in the horticultural society, the Iroquois Indians, women's control over agriculture gave them a far higher status than women in later times. Though there was a sexual division of labor, it did not necessarily confer a dominant role to the men. In fact, most people survived in hunter-gatherer societies not by eating meat, but actually by eating what women were able to gather. You know, sort of running a boar off a cliff was a rather random occasion. Meat was not a plenty. So basically, as they put it, the division of labor between the two sexes is determined by causes entirely different from those that determine the status of women in society today. Peoples whose women have to work much harder than we would consider proper often have far more real respect for women than our Europeans have of theirs. And they go on to say, the social status of the lady of civilization, surrounded by sham homage and estranged from all real work, is socially infinitely lower than that of the hardworking woman of barbarism. And so basically what they lay out is that women's oppression arose and coincided with the rise of the first class divisions in society. When society goes from producing goods for the immediate need of the personal family, the individual, to actually for exchange for other goods. And this is the way Engels put it in The Origins of the Family, Private Property, Class Struggle, The Origin of the Family, Private Property, and the State. An excellent introduction to these ideas. Goes on to say this. The overthrow of mother right was the world's historic defeat of the female sex. The man took command of the home also. The woman was degraded and reduced to servitude. She became the slave of his lust and a mere instrument for the production of children. In order to make certain of the wife's fidelity and therefore the paternity of his children, she is delivered over unconditionally into the power of the husband. If he kills her, he is only exercising his rights. And goes on to discuss the origins of monogamy in early class society. As soon as you had the first surpluses, then there was a concern about how to pass on that surplus to your progeny, and how, of course, could a man be ensured that the progeny was his own, because, of course, we always know who the mother is, we're not always entirely positive who the father is, was to ensure monogamy, but, of course, monogamy imposed on women only. Before class society, the idea of a strictly monogamous pairing of males and females with their offspring, the nuclear family, was unknown to human society. Inequality was also unknown. For more than 2 million years, humans lived in groups made up of people who were mostly related by blood in conditions of relative equality. I mean, the shared misery, they're hardly, it was not something we aspire to, by the way, primitive communism. Human evolution has taken place over a very long time, a period of millions of years. The earliest human ancestors, Homo habilis, probably appeared some 2 million years ago, while anatomically modern humans, Homo sapiens, did not appear until about 200 to 100,000 years ago. While capitalism doesn't free women, it creates the conditions in which women can be liberated. Noting how modern industry in the 19th century was drawing women out of the domestic sphere and into the paid workforce, Marx argued, the fact that the collective working group is composed of individuals of both sexes and all ages must, under the appropriate conditions, turn into a source of humane development. Although in its spontaneously developed brutal capitalist form, the system works in the opposite direction and becomes a pestiferous, love that word, source of corruption and slavery, since here the worker exists for the process of production and not the process of production for the worker. Women's oppression cannot be seen as something separate or parallel to capitalism. Capitalism depends upon the private family, on women's roles as housewives and mothers for its survival. Marx has argued that under capitalism, women's oppression is rooted in privatized reproduction, that is, in women's role within the nuclear family. In the private family, birthing, child-rearing, housework, and food preparation take place as a service to capitalism. Privatized reproduction within the nuclear family consists of bearing and raising the next generation of workers for capitalism and of preparing present-day workers to reproduce their labor each day. This function of the family has become essential to the existence of capitalism as a cheap means of maintaining the labor force. I think some study came out a couple of years ago, I think it was in the United States, of how much it would cost if the system actually paid women for the unpaid labor that they perform in the home. And there's estimates anywhere in the hundreds of billions of dollars to somewhere in the trillions. It's simply a means of capitalism getting away on the cheap and having food, child rearing, housework, cleaning, all the kinds of things that allow human society to go from day to day, or basically workers to survive from day in to day out and make it to the job the next day, are basically provided within the nuclear family for free for the capitalist system. Because capitalism knows two tendencies, dependence on women's unpaid labor in the home and the exploitation of women in the paid labor force, it forces women to bear a double burden of work at home and on the job. Nevertheless, Marx's insight remains valid today. The starting point for women's emancipation is their entry into paid labor, a change which breaks women out of their isolation in the home and gives working class women the collective strength and confidence alongside the men of their class to fight for the rights as both women and workers. Moreover, the wealth and means of production created by capitalism can be used, if collectively seized and placed under workers' control, to socialize household functions such as cooking, cleaning, and childcare in order to liberate women completely. In his draft for the Communist Manifesto, Engels, who usually gets short shrift on that, I mean, they did co-author the thing, he wrote, "Communist society will transform the relations between the sexes into a purely private matter, which concerns only the persons involved and into which society has no occasion to intervene. It can do this since it does away with the private property and educates children on a communal basis, and in this way removes the two bases of traditional marriage, the dependence, rooted in private property, of the women on the man and of the children on the parents." Now let's get to the nitty-gritty. Who benefits from this oppression? And this is, again, where Marxists and feminists diverge. What most theories of oppression have in common is that the idea that working class unity is impossible because each group benefits from the oppression of some other group. It is now unquestioningly accepted among feminist academics and many activists, for example, that women's oppression stems from patriarchy, loosely defined as a system more or less independent of time and place, whereby all men benefit by keeping all women down. To cite just one recent example from a recent anthology on feminist theory and politics, quote, "The first theme is that women as a social group are oppressed by men as a social group, and that this is the primary oppression for women. Patriarchy is the oppressing structure of male domination." But while it is true that individual workers may hold sexist or racist ideas, it is not at all true that workers benefit from them, even if they think that they do. In fact, when one part of the working class is kept down, it helps the bosses to keep the entire class down. Rather than benefiting from the oppression, all workers are hurt by it. Those who argue that male workers have power over women or that white workers have power over black people have no idea what real power is. In their focus on some particular group oppression, they think that another group has power. That is a moral conception of power. The ruling class has the real power through its control of production, of resources, of the means of destruction, and of the means of disseminating ideas. It uses that power to maintain its ability to exploit and make profits unhindered. Workers' power, that is, their ability to change their circumstances and challenge the system, comes from their collective organization and the confidence that they draw from it. Atomized and separate, encouraged to go for each other's throats, workers are powerless. So when a male worker abuses his wife, he is acting not out of power, but out of powerlessness, out of weakness. And when a white worker acts in a racist manner toward a black worker, the white worker is not expressing their own power, but the power of the system over him. In defeat, workers are most susceptible to the prevailing ruling class ideas, racist, anti-immigrant, anti-woman, homophobic, and so on. In periods of large-scale collective struggle, workers find in class solidarity and hatred of all oppression the basis of their real collective power. The bosses consciously foster divisions among workers in order to weaken and defeat their struggles for better conditions. This is openly evident in the written instructions to a detective firm on how to help break the 1919 steel strike in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Quote, "We want you to stir up as much bad feeling as you possibly can between the Serbians and the Italians. Spread data among the Serbians that the Italians are going back to work. Call up every question you can in reference to racial hatred between these two nationalities. Make them realize to the fullest extent that far better results would be accomplished if they will go back to work. Urge them to go back to work, or the Italians will get their jobs." The very conditions of capitalism, you see, they're very honest to themselves. They're very class conscious, the ruling class. You've got to watch these motherfuckers. They're very smart. They're cruel, but they're not stupid. Well, Bush. The very conditions of capitalist exploitation and competition also help to foster division among workers. As socialist, in the United American socialist Sharon Smith, author of Women and Socialism, puts it, "While capitalism propels workers toward collective forms of struggle, it also forces them into competition. The unremitting pressure from a layer of unemployed workers, which exists in most economies, even in times of full employment, is a deterrent to struggle, a constant reminder that workers compete for limited jobs which afford a decent standard of living. Without the counterweight of a class struggle, this competition can act as an obstacle to the development of class consciousness and encourage the growth of what Marx called false consciousness, part of which is the ideas that which scapegoat other sections of society. The growth of such ideas divide workers and impedes their ability to focus on the real enemy. By oppressing a section of the working class on the basis of its sex, race, sexual orientation, language, or national origin, and driving these workers' conditions of existence down, capitalism is able to drive the conditions of all workers down. A white worker may perceive that their conditions of work and pay are better because of the lower pay received by black and women workers. The reality, however, is that the bosses use the conditions of the lowest paid workers to drive the conditions of all workers down. The worse the pay and conditions of the most oppressed workers, the more the bosses can lower the pay of all workers. Conversely, when the conditions of the most oppressed sections of the working class are improved, the conditions of all workers improve. This explains why in the American South, where rampant racism has been used to divide workers and keep unionization rates extremely low, the pay of white workers, though better than that of their black counterparts in the region, is historically lower than the pay of black workers in the American North. Likewise, some male workers may perceive that they benefit from women's oppression. They don't have to do as much housework, for example. But the relative advantage a man gets from this setup doesn't compare either to the benefit capitalism receives from women's unpaid labor in the home or to the gain for both working class men and women if the conditions of women's double burden were lifted. Male workers suffer from the fact that women's wages are still on average lower than theirs, both because it drives down the wages of all workers and because it lowers the financial resources of working class families. The prime beneficiary of women's role in the privatized family is the capitalist class, who does not have to pay for taking care of today's and tomorrow's generation of workers. Even in instances where men and women equally share housework, workers are still stuck in private households, forced to carry a difficult burden that allows no leisure time. One could only laugh or cry at a man who proclaimed his pleasure at the fact that his wife was treated as a sex object at work, could not afford an abortion, could not take paid maternity leave, had trouble finding quality, affordable child care, or received low wages. It is true that oppression, such as racism or sexism, affects all classes in society. But the character and intensity of the oppression is very much shaped by the class that you come from. An unemployed white male auto worker in Flint, Michigan, for example, is far more oppressed than Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, a black woman, if she's oppressed at all. She is part of the American ruling class. Moreover, a black auto worker in Flint, Michigan, shares much more in common in terms of social status, living and working conditions with a white auto worker than he does with Condi Rice or a black businessman, for that matter. More than that, Condi Rice actually benefits from the existing social order. Therefore, whatever her personal views on sexual discrimination or racism, she has a stake in a system that depends upon discrimination and racism. Likewise, there is a wide gulf between the oppression experienced by Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, who can afford maids, cooks, and nannies, and the woman who works for her as a maid or a nanny. They stand apart from each other across a yawning class divide. Hillary has no need to fight for all the things that would free working women from their oppressed condition, such as free and available abortion and other health care, equal pay, child care, and so on, because she can pay for these services and hire working class women to perform these tasks. In fact, complete liberation for all women hurts the interests of her own class, which depends upon women's unpaid labor in the home, the low pay of immigrant workers who tend their lawns, cook their food, and work in their factories, fields, and hospitals. Building women's unity means, in practice, subordinating the interests of working-class women to bourgeois and middle-class women. This sisterhood of women, wrote socialist Elizabeth Gurley Flynn in 1915, like the brotherhood of man, is a hollow sham to labor. Behind all its smug hypocrisy and sickly sentimentality loom the sinister outlines of the class war. The working class struggle cannot be successful unless workers are able to throw off the yoke of oppression that divides them. That is why, as a class, workers not only do not benefit from oppression, but also have a common class interest in fighting oppression. Capitalism would have no need for dividing workers if there were not another dynamic at work, the tendency for capitalism to compel workers to collectively fight back against the various aspects of their oppression and exploitation. American socialist Hal Draper, writing in the 1960s, used a quotation from Marx in saying, "Capital assembles the bourgeois and the proletarians in large cities in which industry can be carried on most profitably, and by this herding together of the great masses in one spot, makes the proletariat conscious of their power. The interests of workers as a group organized by capital lead them to struggle." Elsewhere, Draper writes, "To engage in class struggle, it is not necessary to believe in the class struggle any more than it is necessary to believe in Newton in order to fall from an airplane." The working class moves toward class struggle insofar as capitalism fails to satisfy its economic and social needs and aspirations. There is no evidence that workers like to struggle any more than anyone else. The evidence is that capitalism compels and accustoms them to do so. It is in the course of struggle that the ideas used to divide workers begin to break down, and workers see in practice who the real enemy is. But because capitalism both divides and unites workers, it is necessary to build an organization, a revolutionary socialist party, that brings together the most class-conscious workers and fights to link every small battle against exploitation and oppression in the system with the struggle to overthrow that system as a whole. The British socialist Tony Cliff put it this way: "For any oppressed group to fight back, there is need for hope. And that is to be found not in the isolation of oppression, the housewife trapped in the home, the gay in the closet, the Jews in the ghetto, but in the collective strength of the working class. For Marxists, the notion that the working class, by liberating itself, will liberate the whole of humanity is central, which is why the Revolutionary Socialist Party must support struggles against all forms of oppression, not only of the working class, but of any downtrodden section of society." The way Lenin put it, he said, the Revolutionary Party has got to be the tribune of the oppressed. In the United States, the remnants of the women's movement are immersed inside of the Democratic Party, the party that gutted abortion rights for women. In 86% of counties in the United States, you have no access to abortion. It's legal, but you can't get one. It's ironic that after decades of feminist accusations that socialists don't take women's liberation seriously and that socialists subordinate the fight against women's oppression to the class struggle, socialists have held to the principles of women's liberation that long ago fell by the wayside for feminists. The Russian Bolshevik leader Alexandra Kollontai wrote it this way in 1908: "The women's world is divided just as the world of men into two camps. The interests and aspirations of one group bring it closer to the bourgeois class, while the other group has close connections to the proletariat and its aims for liberation encompass a full solution to the woman question. Thus, although both camps follow the general slogan of the liberation of women, their aims and interests are different. Each of the groups unconsciously takes its starting point from the interests and aspirations of its own class, which gives a specific class coloring to the targets and tasks it sets for itself. However apparently radical the demands of the feminists, one must not lose sight of the fact that the feminists cannot, on account of their class position, fight for that fundamental transformation of society without which the liberation of women cannot be complete. If you're for women's liberation, your goal can only be achieved, I would argue, through the fight for socialism, which is why I encourage folks here to join and get involved with the folks of Socialist Alternative in Australia."